I've got a treat for you today with this guest, Dr. Lisa Diamond. She is going to talk about how sexual fluidity is a flexibility, and you might not have ever looked at it that way. Also, we're going to talk about how trauma and the LGBTQ population has been mischaracterized and what that means. And then lastly, we're going to dive into her TEDx talk, where you really can understand about the adaptive nature of genetics and how it relates to being queer. It's really going to be amazing. Join us. Welcome to the Redhead Reveal Podcast. I am Jen Pinkerton, your Redhead host, a psychotherapist, writer, speaker, the private practice owner of Pinkerton Psychotherapy, and a connection expert. I help people reveal their connectedness within their relationships and sexuality, understanding root causes of beliefs and behaviors that hold them back from success, and assist them to returning to the person that they are born to be before they were limited by trauma, societal or social concerns, or attachment wounds. Redhead Reveal is here to share concerns and questions, provide interviews with thought leaders and friends, and to hold space to discuss life struggles and encourage vulnerability, authenticity, growth, and self-awareness. All right, welcome. Today I have such an exciting guest with Dr. Lisa Diamond. I'm having a fangirl moment here because this is somebody that I really look up to, and her expertise is really unparalleled by anyone else in her in this field and her specialty, I believe. So Dr. Diamond is a distinguished professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah and president of the International Academy for Sex Research. She has her PhD in human development from Cornell University. She spent 3 decades studying the development and expression of gender and sexuality across the life course. Her current work focuses on the biobehavioral mechanisms through which social stigma, social stress, and social safety shape the health and well-being of sexually diverse and gender diverse individuals at different stages of development. She has an amazing book that she wrote in 2008, Sexual Fluidity, which we're going to talk about a little bit. And she's also been awarded various awards. She's the co-editor of the very first ever APA Handbook of Sexuality and Psychology, which is really amazing. And the fellow of 2 different divisions, also the APA. She's published so many articles and written so many things, and it's just really amazing to have you join us today, Dr. Diamond. So thank you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Great. I want to dive right in by starting off and holding up this book, which as an actual student still, and as a therapist, I cannot tell you how many times I've referenced this and referred to this. I think it's so amazing. The book is titled Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. And I want to open with that and kind of start with giving you the opportunity to tell us a little bit about the book in general and what motivated you to write this book about sexual fluidity.
You know, I didn't start out even thinking I was going to write a book. You know, I started the study, and the book is a sort of report of the first 10 years of a research program that's now been going on almost 30 years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wrote the book at the 10-year point, but the study has kept going. And I started the study when I was actually in graduate school. It was the first study I ever started. Mm-hmm. And I was a very young and naive graduate student. I didn't quite know exactly what I was interested in, but I knew that at that point in the early 1990s, I couldn't really find much research on young women's sexual identity development. There was a pretty small emerging body of research on like young men's sexual identity development. What's the process through which you first become aware that you might be gay? People didn't even talk about bisexuals at that time. It was just a different era. And so I basically just set out to try to put women back in the picture. It was really that vague and that broad. And my PhD advisor, Rich Seven Williams, was like, well, you know, what are your questions? I'm like, you know, all of them. Because all the studies at that point sort of tracked sexual identity development by capturing people as adults, asking them to recollect their history. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, oh, well, people say they remember this and they say they remember that. And yet anyone, you know, knows that your memory of your past is always a little bit distorted by where you currently stand. And so it would be really common to hear people say things like, oh, well, I was married for many years, but now I realize that I was always lesbian and I was in denial. And that makes a lot of sense from this kind of standard model that we had about sexual orientation. But I was curious as to kind of what would happen if you capture people at the beginning of that journey and then kind of follow them over time. And so this was pre-internet. So I recruited women like through word of mouth and just asking them, and I didn't even require that they identify as lesbian or bisexual. I just said, if you're attracted to women at all and you're a woman, I kind of want to know what's going on. And I had no money. I was at Cornell, so I bought a used car and I just drove around the state of New York to various cities, recruiting individuals one by one, just saying, would you talk to me about, your journey? And then, I did something that had not been done at the time, which was I followed up with them. About every 2 years, I would recontact them and check back in with them, who they were involved with, who they were having sex with, who they were in love with, how they viewed their identity, how they viewed their attractions. And lo and behold, what I found was that people's trajectories were not nearly as continuous as I think everyone kind of assumed that they're supposed to be. That you would have people who would come out as lesbian, and then maybe 2 years later, they're like, well, I think I might be bisexual because I had this relationship with a guy and I don't really know what that means. Or some people would identify as bisexual and then they'd switch to lesbian and then something else would happen. And their pattern of attractions didn't change all that much, but the way that they made sense of those attractions and the relevance of those attractions for their experience of themselves and their own kind of life paths changed quite a bit. And so what I tried to do, and I've been publishing the data in like academic articles, but I knew from talking to the women that many of them thought there was something wrong with them. That one woman actually said, maybe I shouldn't even be in your study. I don't think I'm a very good example of a lesbian. And I was like, well, do you know there's a whole bunch of bad examples of everything in this data set? And so I felt really strongly about finding a way to kind of summarize the data and talk about the findings in a way that would be accessible and relevant to just the average, person. What I found is that a lot of folks, read the book and then reach out to me and be like, I thought I was the only one with this weird kind of history. And initially, there were a lot of my fellow researchers who would say, I think you just had a weird sample. You're talking about this fluidity. It might just be in this kind of kooky small sample you have. I don't necessarily think it's a general property of sexuality.
That is so interesting that you have
But since that time, there's now a whole bunch of large scale longitudinal data sets. And every time they would come out, I'd be like, okay, I'm relieved because it was not just a weird sample. Science is like, you see what you look for. And the model of sexual orientation and identity that was predominant at that time was a pretty simplistic one and it was a pretty rigid one. And if that's what you're looking for, that's what you're going to see. And the only thing I did different was to just keep listening over time. It wasn't like all that sophisticated. It was just really observing. And I always tell my students, the first step in the scientific process is to observe. And I feel like a lot of the early research on sexual orientation kind of short-circuited that process. We did a lot of interpreting before we really observed. And so that book in many ways, is like a love letter to all my participants, because I didn't really know how to interpret their stories initially. And I had to just sort of, step back and be patient with myself. And when the book came out, I sent each of them a copy because I feel like, they were just ordinary women living their lives, but them just living their lives, I think, ended up changing the way a lot of people think about sexuality over the life course.
And so much of that aspect of being almost pigeonholed into one thing or another is something that I see so often just in my line of work in treating couples, because even from a couple standpoint, there's an idea that we can only be this way. This is all we can be. We're not allowed to be anything different. There is no fluidity. There is no room or margin for us to be explorative about who we are and what we like. And when it comes to, intimacy, even that idea of what I like becomes this very boxed in idea of this is only of what this is what is acceptable. And I think that I preach so much in this way about no one else can define us but us. And I feel like we still today, even though from the standpoint of where you're talking about when this research was done years ago and a decade ago, even today, I think there's so much of a impetus of people wanting to define everyone. And we have to
Although, I think the younger generation, they are less likely to feel that way. And
I
I feel
agree.
like they are, Gen Z, one out of five of Gen Zers view themselves as somewhere on an LGBTQ spectrum. And many of them are not likely to want to pin it down. Notions of fluidity are now just like they take for granted that they're like, oh, labels are terrible, boxes. I'm just gonna be myself. And it's amazing how much has changed even in a generation. But I think that folks who were raised, in previous generations, you can't really undo a lot of that cultural learning just by telling yourself, oh, be free. If you grew up in an era that said, no, you're born one way and your sexual tastes are fixed and that's just who you are, it's hard to give yourself permission to be or feel something different. And a part of that is just the overall sex negativity of the culture.
Yes.
We're so uncomfortable with sexuality at all that the only way we can handle it is to think like, well, it's just a thing inside of you. It's just a thing. We don't think of our sexuality as something that we create every day, that we are always becoming. Human brains are the most plastic brains on the planet. We have such a capacity for self-construction, self-creation, new experiences, novelty in all forms. And of course, that extends to intimacy and desire as well as everything else. But in our sex negative culture, that's kind of terrifying because then that places responsibility on individuals to make active agentic choices to figure out what they want and decide whether or not to act on it. And most folks would rather not even, think about that. We have just such a, not just a sex negative culture, but also a pleasure negative culture. We're
Yes.
not big fans of pleasure. Pleasure is indulgent. Sex is not something you need. It's just like, an ice cream cone once in a while. So all of those things, I think, work to keep us in those boxes and to keep us kind of limited.
And from a standpoint of an idea of being receptive too, because as we're talking about this fluidity, if a woman was in a relationship with a man, then their relationship with a woman, then they decide to be in a relationship with a man again. Oftentimes, there's this sense of, wait a minute, I may not be interested in you because I may think you're gay. And the label is so firm that there doesn't allow for anyone to figure out what they want and what they like and who they are. And I find that so disappointing because, in other ways, we allow people to make a lot of changes in their life. People change careers, they change jobs.
I actually use
They
career development all the time as an
Yes, because
example.
it's,
I
think
say
about it.
like, often if you talk to someone who, has some career in, say, marketing or something, and they, oh, how did you get into that? Well, I did this and then I got this opportunity and I realized I was good at that. And then I did this and I tried that. And then I ended up here. No one ever says, when did you know you were good?
That's
Right.
right.
So we allow for that complexity and variability. Like, yes, there are ingredients. It's like we're all like a cake. We have things that we start with, like the eggs and the butter and the flour. Then it is up to us to like bake our cake. But you know, it we can, you know, we are continuing to cook, you know, all through our lives. And we it's amazing how little you know, flexibility and variability we allow ourselves in one of the most important domains of our lives, which is intimacy.
Absolutely. There's the concept of let's reinvent ourselves as well. You know, let's reinvent who we are. Let's start over. But there's never usually an inclusion of that also pertains to my your sexuality. Who do I want to be in that way? What do I like? What do I don't like? What do I want to explore? You know, the idea of the new year, I often say to people too, okay, you're starting your new year. What are your goals? What's your goal going to be in your intimate life? What's your goal going to be for sex with yourself, with your partner, in general? What is that going to be? What's that going to look like? And oftentimes it's greeted with just this blank face that why would that even be something that we would be considering? But of course we should consider it. It's part of who we are.
Well, we never, that's not a message we ever give to kids. I often like to freak out, you know, my friends who have, you know, children, you know, and the children are like, you know, 12 or 13, I'll say things like, what kind of orgasms do you hope that they'll have one day? And they're like, oh. And I'm like, you know, we imagine, oh, will my kid be a firefighter? Will my kid do this? Will my kid do that? It's like, don't you wish for your child extraordinary pleasure in their lives? And yet most parents don't think about that. They don't think that their child's future pleasure in their own body is their concern. And they don't think that part of their job as a parent is to lay the groundwork for their child to have, you know, fantastic experiences of physical ecstasy. It's that sex negativity, that pleasure negativity. We're more concerned with how much money our kids are going to make than whether they will be able to feel real ownership and agency in their body. And that's just tragic.
But so much of that, I believe, is still shame-based. You know,
Oh, yeah.
it's shame-based, and it's an uncomfortable thing for a lot of people because they haven't dealt with their own feelings about it. So if there's not a healthy sex positive idea about who they are as a person, who they are in their sexuality and their intimacy with the person that they are with, how are
Yeah.
they going to be able to translate that and model to, you know, a teen that's in a burgeoning place of sexuality to be able to explain that it is healthy for you to have
Yeah.
these desires. It's healthy for you to want to figure out who you are. And it is healthy to make that a priority in your future relationships.
Yeah.
It is
Yeah.
a fundamental part of you being happy in that relationship. And
Yeah.
it's just a missing piece. It's just a missing part that I think that I hope as we have continued to evolve and grow and people become more interested in this concept in general, that it will, you know, perpetuate on. And just as the everything's changed in the decade that ago when you did your beginning of research,
And
what
you
it
know, the internet has also played a role because I mean, the average adolescent now can, you know, I'm amazed at how many TikToks I've seen with like teenage girls talking about the clitoris. I'm like, oh, I didn't know about the clitoris. Like, wow, you know, there's a whole like
Right.
the availability of just basic information, it has changed dramatically. And so part of me hopes that the generation of kids that are young adults now will raise their kids differently, will, you know, not have some of the same assumptions that previous generations have had, but we'll see.
Now, for our listeners that may not really understand what the concept of sexual fluidity even is, have maybe an idea, I'd rather you give your definition to really explain it and give that out. I know you talk about the flexibility part of it. So can you give me the and our, you know, our audience the actual definition that you use for that?
Sure. So I define it as a capacity for kind of situation dependent flexibility in sexual desires, sexual attraction, sexual behaviors, and identities. And the exam and some people are like, well, what does that mean? Aren't people like you're either gay or you're not? And I'm like, yeah, sexual orientation is a thing. There are people who have a predisposition for one gender or another or both or neither, but those predispos those predispositions are not nearly as rigid as a lot of us have been led to believe. People used to say things like, oh, your sexual orientation is kind of like your eye color. No, it's not like your eye color. It is a pattern, it's a leaning, it's a bias, but it is not a program. It is not some genetic ping that says this is the only thing you're going to want. And what we know is that as individuals go through their lives and they meet different people, have different experiences, or in different environments, they may encounter individuals or stimuli that kind of activate in them desires that seem unexpected, that are different from their usual. And when that happens, they'll be like, well, wait, how can I possibly have this feeling for this person if I've never had feelings like that for this type of person before? And the answer is like, just because human sexuality is kind of inherently, a malleable system. Humans are not like other mammals in this respect. Humans use sex not just for reproductive functions. Sex is a social act for humans, and you see this in our most closely related primate species. Humans are very unique in the fact that our sexuality is bound up in our interpersonal relationships. It is triggered and activated by our social motivations, by our emotional feelings. And so it's not uncommon at all to have desires for acts, for individuals, for situations that may surprise you. That capacity for flexibility is just a part of what makes us humans. It's nothing unusual. It is the most human thing about us.
So, what would be your response to someone if they say, Dr. Diamond, I have always been with women. It's a man, and he says, and now I want to be with a man, but now I'm back with a woman again. Am I gay? Am I not?
The first thing I would say is, why do you ask that question in that way? Why do you want to know what you are? To some degree, the most relevant question is, are you happy? What do you want? What kind of sex and what kind of relationships do you want? Now, that's not to say that identity isn't important. I'm a queer woman. My queer identity is very important to me. But one of the things that I find problematic is when people go into their own self-exploration with this question of what am I? As if there's something about themselves that they don't know yet, and once they figure it out, they'll be kind of fine.
It's so
Rather
relevant.
than going into that exploration by saying, what is my body telling me? What feels good? What doesn't feel good? What am I experiencing somatically in my body and my mind? And what do I want to do about that? There are definitely, individuals who will find that over the course of their life, they just have a pretty reliable pattern of attractions to more than one gender. And knowing that about themselves may give them a sense of meaning and purpose and flexibility. Others may be like, well, I think I'm generally leaning toward this end, but sometimes I have these other feelings. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're bisexual. They just might have a really flexible sexual system. And so, a lot of people say, well, what's the difference between being fluid and being bisexual? It's hard to know, right? Because the outcome, at least from an observational perspective, is kind of the same. You have more possibilities than you probably thought. And rather than saying, what am I think a better question is, what do I want? What do I want? And what do I want to do?
And there's a difference in just the way you're positioning that, because to me, one question, that first question, is so surface level. It doesn't allow for anyone to have any sort of soul searching about the depth of what excites them.
What feels good? What's interesting? What do they want to try? What do they not want to try? It's the self-exploration part that I think so many people miss. And
I think, related to that, what I found with a lot of the women in my study is some of them would say, I feel like my attractions to one gender are more like emotionally based, and my attractions to this other gender can be emotional, or they can be more physical. And even that is an important question that we don't really encourage kids to ask themselves. What's the difference between that passionate feeling of love and that kind of visceral experience of lust? Mm-hmm. We assume that they always go together all the time,
mm-hmm.
but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
People have lust without, love. People have love without lust. They have them together. And some individuals are more likely to develop sort of, more love relationships with one gender and more lust relationships with another. And people are like, well, what orientation is that? What is that? And I'm like, it doesn't really matter. But what that does tell you is some information about how you operate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to make decisions about, what you want in your life, then knowing how you respond to different genders, that's data for you. That it's not about what you are, it's what is your pattern and what do you want in your life?
And that question, I want to lead with that. What do you want in your life? If more people asked that question, just about everything,
mm-hmm.
I think there would be so much more information that they would gather in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And it would lead to a lot of people being a heck of a lot happier. You know, it's the foundation of where it all begins when you're trying to do this emotional work to figure out, hey, what do I want my life to look like and feel like?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard because we have such a shame-based culture that most folks, even that inner search of what do I want makes them feel icky and yucky, and so we make it really hard for people to do that sort of self-exploration, in this context.
I want to touch on something else that I really loved reading and hearing you talk about, which was this association that's this it's mischaracterization, but an association that's completely wrong about I maybe had a traumatic childhood, so I'm gay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Instead of I'm gay and I also had a traumatic childhood.
Yeah.
And I really would love for you to spend a few minutes on that and explaining to everyone your thoughts on that.
Yeah, this is something I've gotten a lot more interested in, partly because the data that we collect now is just more reliable data.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been this stereotype that, it's a part of the oldest models of sexual orientation were like, oh, like it's a disease, it's something that went wrong, you're damaged goods, somebody hurt you, somebody maltreated you, and it turned you, it twisted your sexuality in some weird way. It's the same thing they say about, pedophiles.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we know that pedophilia also appears to be an orientation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's like there some people have biases in their attractions. People are born with predispositions. And those predispositions do not always express themselves,
Mm-hmm.
cleanly and clearly. One of the things that we know is that among folks who are openly identified as, lesbian, gay, or bisexual, they are more likely than heterosexually identified individuals to report having childhood adversity. And adversity broadly defined, which includes things like having mental illness in the home, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, poverty, having a parent that's incarcerated, having a very unpredictable childhood. And then, there's been a lot of awareness over the past, I'd say, decade on the ways in which early childhood adversity shapes our development in multiple ways, partly because our brains are so plastic.
Yes.
And one of the things we know is that, although we used to think of as childhood adversity as like a thing that damages you and gives you a deficit, what we now know is that basically adversity was the normative state
mm-hmm.
for humans across
mm-hmm.
human evolution. If you've ever watched Game of Thrones, those childhoods were more like what human childhoods were like.
Mm-hmm.
People lost their siblings. They experienced parental loss, parental abandonment, all the things that now we think of as being a troubled childhood were kind of universal in the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness.
Correct.
And so we know that, you know, our brains evolved to just cope, to adapt. And some of those adaptations have to do with the way the human brain processes fear and reward, you know, because our brain is designed to just keep us going and keep us surviving. And one of the things that gets altered in kids that have been exposed to early adversity is that their kind of sensitivity to short-term rewards appears to be heightened. And it's thought that this is a part of the survival mechanism, because you're a child who's exposed to adversity, the brain is getting the signal, your life might be very short. Mm-hmm. You may not be able to rely on anything. So it's like, okay, speed up. Kids exposed to early adversity often develop more quickly. They often reach sexual maturity more quickly. They often start having sex more quickly. And we used to think, oh, that's just because they fall in with the wrong crowd. Now there's evidence to suggest that that's actually part of our evolution, because it's like, hey, you're in a dangerous world. Grow up now. Mm-hmm. And when you find a reward that you can get it, mm-hmm. get it. There's
right,
no,
you may not have a long lifespan.
May not have a long lifespan. So that sensitivity to reward is heightened. And so that helps us understand a little bit about the higher rates of early adversity in queer populations. My sort of way of understanding that is, if you have a predisposition for queerness, like lurking in your brain, and you have been exposed to early adversity, it's almost like that signal to noise ratio is dialed up, mm-hmm. because your brain is now saying, where are my rewards? Mm-hmm. Where is what I want, and how do I get it? And so those individuals are going to figure that out. It's almost like that's a bell they hear ringing in the back of their head. So it's not that abuse makes you gay. Abuse may make your gayness more like you can't avoid it. It'll be a sound that you can't unhear.
It's like vibration. It's that higher level of that energy.
Yeah. And so, you know, we need to be, and the reason I think it's important is because the rates of, you know, rates of early adversity are just high in general. Like, we have a lot of denial in, you know, about how common maltreatment is.
Yes.
And now that we know more about how it actually changes the way our bodies respond to information, respond to stress, respond to adversity, then we need to take that into account when we think about mental health in adulthood. Individuals who have been exposed to early childhood threat will experience danger differently for the rest of their life. And that's not a deficit. That's an adaptation. That's the brain trying to save you. And so if you've got a population like queer people who have higher rates of early adversity because they kind of figured out their queerness, you know, earlier because of that, then when you think about the mental health challenges that they're going to face for the rest of their life, you cannot ignore that history. You have to really wrestle with it. And I think that there's a lot of shame, you know, always in kids that have had hard childhoods. And that shame really prevents us from really reckoning with the fact that those things that happen to you, that are a part of how your brain works, they are not flaws. They are a part of human diversity. They are adaptations. They are both superpowers and kryptonites.
Absolutely.
You know, things like, you know, this sort of, I know some folks who talk about having a spidey sense, you know, for danger, folks who've had a lot of early adversity.
Hypervigilance. Yes.
Those things can be distracting and annoying and problematic, but they got you here.
That's right.
That is your brain trying to save you. So it's like, you just have to have a way of be like, there's my adaptation. There it is showing up again. It doesn't mean I'm damaged. It means I'm stress adapted. I have a colleague Bruce Ellis, who says we need to start using terms like, you know, adapted, stress adapted, instead of like damaged, troubled.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, stress adapted kids have a lot of skills that average kids don't even have.
Well, when we start saying words like damage or being broken, we're pathologizing everything instead of recognizing that sometimes we deserve a pat on the back for how amazing our bodies were in coping, how amazing our survival instincts are. Because, you know, oftentimes the idea of even our personality is nothing short of a set of trauma responses that have created who we are. You know, and your TEDx talk, I love your TEDx talk about Born This Way and how you really address some of these myths and misnomers and the way people view this entire concept. One of the things that stood out to me so much, you said that gender and sexual development show a lot more variability than most people realize, and that that variability changes over time.
I thought that
was so profound and so succinct. Tell me your thoughts kind of more on that.
You know, it's so interesting because some people interpret the existence of, say, sexual fluidity as like, oh, so we're all just like randomly, like everything is possible at all times. And it's like, no, there are periods of development that are more open and periods of development that sort of stabilize. And I was really influenced, you know, by reading a lot of research on sort of developmental systems theory, which talks about how, you know, humans are always sort of changing and restabilizing and changing and restabilizing. We sort of oscillate between periods of openness and then realignment, and things will sort of settle down. And then another window of change opens up and then things settle down. So we have this capacity for variability over the life course, but even that capacity is variable. And those windows open and close at different rates for individuals. We know that the greatest period of variability is in early childhood. That's when the brain is most plastic.
Right.
But even that, like, the brain stays pretty plastic until age 25.
Well, we form neural pathways all day long, every day. We have the ability to
signature characteristic of humans.
That's right. Yeah,
I like to see there's only one way that humans are born, and that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
We're born changing and we keep changing.
Absolutely.
And that can be, you know, destabilizing in the moment for people who are in a period like that. But it's also why therapy works.
That's right.
It's also why healing works. It's
and if we can shift the perspective a bit to recognize that changing doesn't have to be a bad thing.
Yeah.
Those changes we can actually embrace with some curiosity. And having a little bit of curiosity, I think, goes so far, you know?
But some folks are afraid to find out what they want. You know, if you look too hard at your life and you're like, wow, I really have no sexual attractions for my, you know, spouse at all. Like, that can be a really terrifying change.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's kind of problematic in our culture is that we don't do a very good job of saying to people in coupled relationships, for example, hey, if your desires for your partner kind of change, maybe, you know, what about an open relationship? Or what about, you know, what about kink? What about all these other things?
Yeah.
We are just like, oh, well, then get divorced. Then it's over.
That's right.
No real acceptance of saying, as your sexuality changes, you have a lot of choices you can make about what to do with that, where to go with that, who to bring into that. You know,
I find it really sad when people give up on their relationship. And that's so much of the work I do. You know, let's talk about, have you ever had a conversation about what your fantasies are? Have you ever talked about yuck and youngs? Have you ever even explored, you know what, this could look entirely different. And instead, people either are so shame-based or they're so afraid of the judgment and they can't be vulnerable enough to talk about what they're feeling and thinking and wanting.
Yeah. And to be fair to some folks, often one person may be willing to do that and the partner may not be.
Mm-hmm.
And the partner may find that threatening. And,
right.
You know, that remains, I think, an enduring challenge. And I think especially for women because our culture has such restrictive notions of female sexuality that if you're a woman who's partnered with a man and you're the one who's saying, I might want something different, I might be the one who wants to sort of think about that to someone who's been conventionally socialized as a cisgender or heterosexual man, you are likely to find that threatening. And that comes from the way that we raise children.
Absolutely. Instead of thinking, let me embrace what my partner is talking about, because wow, I may be in for this amazing, great ride that's going to further our relationship in such a cemented and connected way that we could be in a year from now in such a better place that we never even thought we would get. And our life can look so very different and we can be together.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think there's a lot of research on, you know, polyamory that shows that often having a relationship with someone outside the primary partner or even just developing an attraction, that often ends up re-energizing the relationship with the primary partner. And so our culture has this notion of like, oh, if you're attracted to somebody else, that's like a threat, instead of saying, hey, anything that turns you on, that wakes you up to your body, you can choose to connect that to your current relationships. But that's not the message that we give.
Well, I define it as a spark. It's a spark. And even Esther Perel talks about how, you know, sometimes in the situation of infidelity comes a heightened and better sex life after, if that couple chooses to work through that because of that. It's exactly what you're talking about. And the research does indicate that it's a scientific fact that that is what happens. But so many people are very afraid to embrace that concept because of the detriment or effects of what that could mean. And it might create a freedom that people are very uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
Also in your TEDx talk, you talked about the evidence for the genetic contribution. And I want to touch on that too, because I thought that was really exciting. Tell me what you thought about that as well.
You know, in the early 90s, there was all this research on whether there was a single gene that made people gay or straight. And there's not a single gene. It turns out that there are hundreds, potentially like thousands, of genes that collectively change that bias that might that have, you know, the best analogy that I've heard used is rigged dice. That, you know, if you're cheating at a dice game, you throw a dice and it's weighted so that the six will be more likely to come up. That's not a guarantee that'll come up. You know, you have weighted dice, but there's still how hard you throw it, how far you throw it, what surface it falls on. And so the genetic contributions to sexuality are like rigged dice. They change the probability of certain patterns, but they don't determine the pattern. And so when we look at identical twins who have identical genes, even in identical twins, if one twin is kind of queer in some way, the other twin is queer only 30% of the time. And so, and they have identical genes. So now, and 30% is way higher than the base rate.
Right.
That is definite evidence that genes play a role, but they do not provide the final role. Mm-hmm. And we know, you know, the other thing I point out when I talk about this, I'm like, anyone who knows two identical twins, do you treat them as if they're the same person?
No, absolutely not.
We know that the moment those kids come out of the womb, they start differentiating. Mm-hmm. They are chewing up the environment and their brains, they are becoming themselves. The gene is just a starting point. It's the same for sexuality. And so there are genetic influences, but there's no genetic determination. Mm-hmm. And so we need to, you know, we used to talk about like nature versus nurture. There's no dichotomy. It is both and 100% of the time. We are genetically influenced. And that's just doesn't tell us very much at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. I want to end this with this question that I always ask. I give an opportunity for the prior guest that was on to ask a question for a future guest. And I want to give that to you. And then I want to give you a chance to leave me a question for my next guest. And it's kind of my way of perpetuating thinking outside the box, because everyone that I have join on this podcast has their own level of specialization or expertise. And by asking these questions, we're linked together in a common way. And I think it makes it really fun. So the last guest question was, are your current fears holding you back from something? So let me let you think for a second. And while you're thinking, I want to tell our audience that I'm going to link in the show notes your TEDx talk, Born This Way, because I think it's so amazing. And I'm going to link in my in the storefront for your book, Sexual Fluidity, so everyone can find those two and your website. And I think that this entire podcast was so amazing and enlightening. And you're just such an expert in your field. And I'm so grateful that you shared some of this really profound work that you've done with everybody. And it's been wonderful.
I appreciate that so much.
So what do you think? Do you have a current fear that's holding you back from anything?
You know, I this may not be true, but the pandemic was really transformational for me. I sort of broke down and rebuilt myself, and I sort of began to systematically kind of confront and deal with all of the fears that were holding me back. And I made a lot of kind of hard changes in my life. I've tried to live more authentically than I ever have before. And so now I'm almost addicted to that. Like now I'm like a fear and inauthenticity seeking missile. And it's like, wherever I find it, it's like a bug that I need to squish. So I actually feel freer right now in my life. And I'm 52. And a part of my sort of awakening was like, I still have a lot of time left.
Absolutely.
I can live the life that, you know, I want. And you know, me and my wife and I have been together for 29 years. And Esther Perel says, you know, most of us will have more than one marriage in our life, and hopefully it'll be, you know, with the same person. And so part of that was we really worked on like, what do we want this partnership to be?
Right.
In almost every way. And so I really feel like my goal now is to search out those fears and to not have them hold me back
or
hold
love that.
My family back. And it's hard because, you know, it requires that you be really accountable you know, with yourself. But I feel fortunate that the pandemic sort of woke me out of stasis and made me take accountability for how my fear had really held me back in the past.
I appreciate you answering that. Do you have a question that you can leave for one of my guests? Okay.
I want to know if you could go back to your, let's say, 15-year-old self, what would you want to tell that self about sex and love? What reassurance, what knowledge, like if you could whisper into the ear of your 15-year-old self, what would you say?
That's beautiful. I can't wait to see what that answer is going to be. It's been such a pleasure having you, Dr. Diamond. Thank you for taking the time to share with me and our audience. Such groundbreaking work, so interesting. And everyone will be able to find you and follow you in all my show notes and be able to really get this book. I want to show it again for everyone on YouTube, Sexual Fluidity, Lisa Diamond. Thank you so much for your time today.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.